This is VOA News. I'm Michael Brown. U.S. President Joe Biden says former President Donald Trump poses a risk to democracy. AP correspondent Norman Hall reports.
Speaking at a fundraiser in Arizona, President Biden said the Make America Great Again movement is an existential threat to the U.S. political system. He said his predecessor is more interested in personal power than upholding the nation's core values. Biden said some mainstream Republicans are complicit.
When we put partisanship aside and put country first, I say we must and we will.
The president spoke at a celebration of a library to be built honoring his friend and fierce Trump critic, the late Republican Senator John McCain. I'm Norman Hall.
Calls for accountability grew on Thursday for the victims of a deadly fire at an Iraqi wedding celebration. Reuters correspondent Edward Barron says grief-stricken mourners attended a crowded memorial service.
At a funeral the day before, the groom was among the crowds of people weeping. Calls for accountability were growing in the Christian town of Handaniya as grief-stricken mourners watched their loved ones being buried. More than 100 people died and at least 150 were injured on Tuesday evening in an inferno that government officials have said was enabled by a lack of safety and security measures and the use of highly flammable materials in the building. In a sermon interrupted at times by the wails of women clad in black, a priest at Al-Tahira Church told mourners that Iraq had been united in grief, but he criticized officials for their corruption.
Reuters' Edward Barron reporting there. As always, for details on much more news, we invite you to join us at our website. That is voanews.com, also on the VOA mobile app. This is VOA News. Local officials say that a car bombing hit a meat market in central Somalia, killing 6 people and wounding 14 others. Thursday's bombing was the third attack of the day in the volatile East African country. No group has claimed responsibility for the attack in the town of Bulobird in the Hiran region, or 2 earlier attacks where no injuries were reported. Somalia faced frequent attacks by the country's al-Qaeda affiliate, the militant group Al-Shabaab. House Republicans have launched their first formal impeachment inquiry hearing against President Biden. We get more on that story from AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani.
James Comer and other GOP committee chairs say there is a clear link between the president and his son Hunter's overseas businesses.
A mountain of evidence revealing how Joe Biden abused his public office for his family's financial gain.
Democrat Jamie Raskin says there is no evidence the president did anything wrong.
No gun, no smoke.
And key witnesses like George Washington University law professor Jonathan Turley, who was called by the GOP, say so far,
I do not believe that the current evidence would support articles of impeachment.
The hearing unfolded with the Democrats displaying a screen counting down the hours and minutes until a government shutdown.
People are going to be hurt when this time runs out.
With Maryland's Kwesi Mfume blasting Republicans for wasting the time on a political stunt.
Why in the hell are we playing this game?
Sagar Magani, Washington.
With a government shutdown looming in less than 2 days, if lawmakers cannot break a stalemate with some Republicans, VOA's Alexis Strope reports contingency plans are being developed.
State Department spokesperson Matthew Miller said on Thursday that the U.S. State Department has been conducting contingency planning in case of a government shutdown.
We continue to work through that planning in the coming days to make decisions about what functions are essential, what functions are essential to national security that cannot be suspended even in the case of a shutdown, and what functions, unfortunately, do have to be suspended.
House of Representatives Republicans, led by a small faction of hardline conservatives, have rejected spending levels for fiscal year 2024, set in a deal that Speaker Kevin McCarthy negotiated with President Joe Biden in May. Republicans control the House by a 221 to 212 margin. I'm Alexis Strope, VOA News.
Three people are confirmed dead after a gunman shot into a classroom at a university hospital campus, striking a teacher, then shooting a mother and daughter at a nearby house on Thursday in the Dutch port city of Rotterdam. The suspect was arrested outside of the hospital. Authorities are trying to determine a motive for the attack. I'm Michael Brown, VOA News.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty, Washington. Today is Friday, September 29, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The U.S. sanctioned Sudan's former foreign minister for his role in the country's conflict.
I think the U.S. is frustrated, and I think now it appears now they are expanding using those sanctions as a way of pushing both sides to come to the table and negotiate a way out of this mess.
Liberians respond to U.S. visa restriction threat for would-be election troublemakers. The U.S. PEPFAR program that fights AIDS in Africa seeks reauthorization, but will congressional Republicans approve it? Guinea's justice minister freezes the salaries of some judges.
The minister, Charles Wright, is being accused by the judges of wanting to force them to return to their different working places without settling the disagreement.
And a Kenyan publisher uses artificial intelligence to help make education more accessible and affordable. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley's polls are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The United States Treasury Department has imposed sanctions on Sudan's former Foreign Affairs Minister, Ali Kati. He is accused of contributing to the outbreak of conflict between the army and the Rapid Support Forces, the RSF, in April this year, and undermining efforts to reach a ceasefire. The U.S. Treasury has also imposed new sanctions on two procurement and military supply companies affiliated with the RSF. Nabil Biagio spoke with Bakri El Madni, a Sudanese political analyst and associate professor of economics at Long Island University, to understand the significance of these sanctions.
This is not new. It has been in the making for a while. U.S. officials, and specifically Secretary of State Blinken, multiple times, he mentioned that the U.S. is open to using different tools. Some of them are diplomatic tools, such as mediating and trying to negotiate a ceasefire. And they have done in the past, multiple times in Jeddah. And unfortunately, all this truce and peace, ceasefire completely collapsed. And none of them could be called to have held even during 8 days. So I think the U.S. is frustrated. And I think now, since the 2 weeks ago, they also announced sanctions against Abdelrahim Dagalo, the second man in command of the RSF. It appears now they are expanding using those sanctions as a way of pushing both sides to come to the table and negotiate a way out of this mess, because there is no end to this war by any side winning it anytime soon. So it makes sense to the U.S. taking some action and using those methods to force the hands of those who are influential, and also specifically by targeting the two RSF companies. This is not just a matter of twisting their arms. It's also limiting their supply chain and making it difficult for RSF to receive assistance from Russia and weapons and advanced type of technologies. Eventually, they will run out of ammunition, they run out of guns, and they might not be able to continue to fight, even though we know that's a very difficult undertaking to accomplish.
Along with sanctioning these companies, RSF-affiliated companies, the Treasury Department also sanctioned Ali Kerti, a former Sudanese Foreign Affairs Minister, for, and I quote, let me read you a little bit of that section, for undermining the former civilian-led transitional government and the framework political agreement process which he contributed to the outbreak of fighting between SAF and the RSF on April 15. He and other hardline Sudanese Islamists are actively obstructing efforts to reach a ceasefire to end the current war between SAF and the RSF and opposing Sudanese civilians' efforts to restore Sudan's democratic transition. What is your comment on that?
They still use the term Islamist as a way to refer to themselves, but in reality, this alliance has been in the making since 2011, after the South decided to become state. They are completely to grab of the state, and the motive is to control the resources and use every means as a kleptocrat to use the state as a facade for them to amass wealth. There is not one faction. Ali Kerti is one of the strongest factions, because he happened to be the strong man with a lot of money. And he has been trying, it's not even a secret, to become the de facto leader of the movement. Of course, the movement at this point, it's very hard to imagine what kind of aspirations, what agendas, what ideology it actually espouses to.
Speaking of Ali Kerti not being the only person, it's interesting that Hemeti, the RSF leader, Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, In many recordings, he accused the Islamists of igniting this war, and he mentioned Ali Kerti several times, Ali Kerti, Osama Abdullah, and others that he designated as Islamists and the reason behind this war.
He's a man of influence, he's a man of wealth, and he's a de facto emir of the Islamic movement. Specifically, so many of the high-ranking officers in Sudanese army, they respect him and they have their allegiance to him more than they have it for General Burhan, because they have a hierarchy of the Islamic organization that is functioning within the Sudanese armed forces.
Bakri El Medni is a Sudanese political analyst and associate professor of economics at Long Island University. He was speaking with my colleague Nabil Biagio. Liberians have welcomed the threat by the United States to impose visa restrictions on Liberians who undermined democracy during the country's October 10 presidential and legislative election. Denise Nipson has more from Monrovia.
With less than 12 days left before the vote, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken warned Wednesday that Washington will impose visa restrictions on individuals who impede democracy in Liberia, a series of inflammatory comments from political party leaders ahead of the polls have created fear in the country. The U.S. Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for West African Affairs, Michael Heath, who is currently visiting Liberia, held a news conference Thursday and reiterated the threat.
The United States will pursue visa restrictions for those believed to be responsible for or complicit in undermining democracy in Liberia.
The warning has raised concerns across the country. Adama Dempster is the National Secretary of the Civil Society Human Rights Platform. He says the U.S. visa threat is timely given the recent crisis in Africa.
Given the wave of how governance, democracy have been engaged in Africa, with the wave of coup d'etats all over, and the sensitivity of rigged elections across the continent, that thing becomes a way in which the U.S. itself could come up with some stringent measures.
And ordinary Liberian Alexander Tia also tells VOA he welcomes the U.S. announcement, particularly as campaigning intensifies.
We are looking at an electoral process that have 13 to 12 vote days. So many statements coming from statements, Waka, Prince Johnson, other guys throwing casket. So that is a fine decision the American government are taking. Let us remain calm. Let us go to the process. Who wins?
TS reference to toting or casket refers to a controversial protest in which supporters of the Coalition for Democratic Change, or CDC, said they were carrying a casket bearing the standard bearer of the Unity Party, Ambassador Joseph Yuma Boakai. Alfred Kandakai Kuma says the U.S. visa threat is in Liberia's interest. However, he says he's frustrated with the lack of enforcement of past pronouncement against well-known politicians, including former Minister of State for Presidential Affairs Nathaniel McGill and Bill Tuari, former Managing Director of the National Port Authority, among others.
U.S. government account of a lot of statement against state actors and other people, other prominent people in this country. No action taken against it, like the sanction against McGill, the sanction against Bill Tuari, the sanction against NRC for Senator Johnson. Up to current, the U.S. government have not done anything. The guys in the contesting election, if they win, they will sit at the Senate or the House of Representatives. So for me, sometimes I feel disappointed about the U.S. government statement. But really, the statement is welcome.
Liberians are hopeful that the statesmen who serve as a deterrence to ensure a peaceful, free, and fair election. For VOA's Daybreak Africa, I'm Denise Nipsey in Monrovia, Liberia.
In Guinea, it appears there may be hurdles ahead for the trial of the suspects of a 2009 stadium massacre. The country's justice minister on Thursday froze the salaries of some judges who have been on strike for better conditions. On September 28, 2009, Guinean security forces fired on opposition protesters, killing more than 150 people. The trial of the alleged perpetrators, including former military leader Captain Moussa Dadis Camara, is set to resume on October 3rd. Reporter Karim Camara in Conakry tells me the freezing of the judges' salaries is likely to impact the trial.
This comes as a result of a breakdown in negotiations with the striking judges, because the minister, Charles Wright, is being accused by the judges of wanting to force them to return to their different working places without settling the disagreement that exists between the Association of Ghanaian Magistrates, the Department of Justice, particularly the Minister of Justice. So decided not to go anywhere but to stay in Conakry and not even to return to work. So the minister phoned them several times, but this time around, so he decided to at least to freeze the salaries of 15 magistrates out of 300 magistrates across the country that are on strike.
What would the impact be on the September 8th stadium massacre trial?
Well, the impact is very, very colossal. And it's very damaging as well, to say the least. Because the September trial, yes, as you've said rightly, was supposed to start Thursday, but to no avail yet. Because majority of these judges are on strike. So once in a while, one or two judges will return to their courtrooms to hear just about one or two cases. But at times, they used to hear like six, seven, up to eight cases. But now, few judges just return to just hear one or two cases and then go back home. The 28th September trial, it's also part of this issue. According to one of the judges, Jacob Boy Gwevogi, who is a judge at the Court of Repression and Economic Crimes here, even accused the minister, saying it's very wrong because the minister quoted Article 33, Guinean Penal Code, and through which he decided to say he's suspending the salaries of this magistrate. Now, according to Mr. Gwevogi, he says that article is completely misinterpreted by the minister. Article 33 means that all judges must reside where they are working. You cannot be in Conakry, for example, and then you are working in a town that is about 50 kilometers, like in Koya. So he says that one is quite impossible. So he says that even the president of the republic has no right to freeze a salary of a judge like that, let alone the minister. But the impact on court hearings across the country is really worrisome, because some parents have started grumbling, and you can also see victims who are saying that now the one justice is delayed, and then you have victims, you have people who have been charged and that are in court. They say themselves they want to at least be in court, at least to prove their innocence, or those who want to be sentenced say, yes, I want to go to court now and to get sentenced, but all this has been suspended.
That's reporter Karim Kambara in the Guinean capital, Conakry. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Friday, September 29. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And still to come on our program, Samson O'Malley Sports. The U.S. President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, also known as PEPFAR, will expire in just a few days. Analysts say unless Congress acts urgently to renew it, the world could lose the program. According to available statistics, PEPFAR has saved 25 million lives, most of them in Africa. An additional 5.5 million kids have been born disease-free because the U.S. government paid for the drugs that reduce the risk of mother-to-child transmission. However, some Republicans in the U.S. House of Representatives reportedly refused to move forward with a five-year reauthorization of the program. Leila Nimitala is Vice President for Advocacy and Mobilization for First Focus on Children, a bipartisan advocacy organization. She tells viewers Douglas Mpuga that it is likely that Congress may undo one of the greatest successes in health, public policy, and international relations.
If Congress fails to reauthorize PEPFAR by midnight, September 30th, the implications could be devastating, really devastating, for millions of the world's most vulnerable children living in some of the poorest places on the planet. Right now, PEPFAR is saving and protecting the lives of 7.2 million children, vulnerable children and their caregivers. And without a five-year clean reauthorization by Congress, that could completely disappear.
There is talk in Congress that maybe a revised version may be reauthorized.
How would that affect the program?
At First Focus, we strongly, strongly advocate that Congress keep PEPFAR as it is without revision, except changing the dates, of course, and cleanly reauthorize it for the next 5 years. Because really, anything less than that would put orphans and vulnerable children at grave risk. And it would also signal to our partner countries, especially those in Africa, that our long-term support from the United States side is at risk.
Yeah, your organization deals with children, but the sticking issues in Congress among some is against the renewal because they say some of the funds may be used for abortion and family planning. What's your take on that?
What I would say is that over the past 20 years, PEPFAR has saved 25 million men, women, and children from HIV. It's ensured that 5.5 million kids have been born with HIV. And simply put, it saved and protected the lives of millions and millions of kids. And to put PEPFAR at risk now is putting those children, the most vulnerable children in the world, at risk too. So we believe it's simply unacceptable.
Children were specifically impacted, and many people were impacted by the COVID pandemic. If this reauthorization doesn't go through, likely they'll reverse the fight against HIV and AIDS in some regions. So what happens if that situation arises?
We're very worried about that too, because without PEPFAR, our huge global advances against HIV and AIDS over the past 20 years could be lost. And definitely the progress made to protect children would be lost. And it could put millions more children at future risk.
What's your message to members of Congress who are responsible for the reauthorization?
Our message is we're urgently calling on Congress to reauthorize PEPFAR for the next 5 years, a clean reauthorization, keeping everything the same and ensuring that 10% of resources are provided to protect orphans and vulnerable children worldwide.
There are those who say that even if they don't reauthorize the PEPFAR, some programs may continue. Do you believe that?
Some programs may continue, but particular programs that protect and save the most vulnerable children and orphans may not continue. We have reason to believe they may not continue without specific reauthorization from Congress.
Leila Nimatola is the Vice President for Advocacy and Mobilization for First Focus on Children. She spoke with my colleague Douglas Mpuga from Washington, D.C. A publisher in Kenya is using artificial intelligence technology to help make education more accessible and affordable. Victoria Amunga reports from Nairobi.
The cost of books and materials is too high for many poor Kenyans who want to get an education. Books for the school year can cost more than $100, more than many can afford to pay. To help Longhorn Publishers in Kenya create an online platform called Loho Learning, it is enabled by artificial intelligence and helps users access all textbooks and videos for $15. Founder James Onganga says the goal is to provide a quality education.
So the first product that we came up with was e-books, because books make one of the core elements of learning within the education curriculum. Secondly is comprehension. So books alone don't get learners to meet their learning objectives. You also need technology to help ensuring that there is understanding within classroom.
The Loho Learning platform is available both online and offline to help those who have no or limited access to internet. Doreen Lusega is Loho's content creator.
Let me take a subject like science, integrated science, where they learn about, finding the pH of various things at home. So in our virtual lab, we have simulations that enable them to do that, so they can, drain those solutions and measure the pH. So that is making it more live than what they just read in a book.
Officials say more than 25,000 students like Susan Namutosia are using the platform, including camp refugees and people living in remote areas.
Reading online is easy to understand simply because the notes are specifically arranged and you can get them easily. But reading the textbook, you can waste a lot of time by searching for the notes. the washing away of the soil.
According to the UNESCO Institute for Statistics, sub-Saharan Africa has the highest rate of education exclusion. Over one-fifth of children between the ages of 6 and 11 are out of school. The Kenyan government says it will be implementing reforms to help increase attendance in primary schools. Innovators like Onganga say artificial intelligence can change traditional learning and reduce the equity gap in education. Victoria Amunga, VOA News, Nairobi.
The Malian army has reported attacks on three of its posts in north, west and center of the country, with an al-Qaeda-linked jihadist group claiming responsibility for two and a separatist grouping claiming the other. The army said on social media that its camp in Diora in the central Mopti region was hit by a terrorist suicide attack on Thursday without giving further details. The coordination of Azawa movement said it had taken the camp, according to a spokesperson for the Alliance of Tuareg-dominated groups seeking autonomy or independence from the Malian state. It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Friday morning to you, Samson.
Good Friday morning to you too, James. We begin the sports in Italy, where Serie A club Napoli have apologized to Nigeria international and Napoli forward Victor Osimhen after posting an offensive TikTok about the player earlier in the week. Osimhen had threatened legal action against the Serie A champions after the club shockingly posted a disparaging TikTok video following a missed penalty in a 0-0 draw with Bologna on Sunday evening. The post notably infuriated the striker, who deleted all Napoli-related content on his own Instagram account shortly afterwards. Napoli said the club's now-deleted social media post was not intended to mock the Nigerian international. Staying with football news, FIFA has sanctioned Rwanda's CAF Confederations Cup campaigners, Rayon Sports, from registering new expatriate players. The directive from the World Football Governing Body come after the club refused to pay Tanzanian goalkeeper Ramadhani Kabwili, who left in April. The player joined Ryan from Tanzanian champions Yanga SC in August of 2022. After just 9 months, his contract was terminated and he dragged the club to FIFA. In women football news, there were shock results in the Women Africa Cup of Nations qualifiers as Cameroon's indomitable Lionesses, four-time finalists of the Women's Africa Cup of Nations, are out of the 2024 tournament in Morocco after being eliminated by Kenya's Harambee Starlets. Cameroon, the 1-0 winner in the first leg, fell twice to Kenya, first in regulation time and then losing 4-3 in the fateful penalty shootout. For the first time since 1991, the indomitable Lionesses will not participate in the final phase of the Women Africa Cup of Nations. Cote d'Ivoire suffered a similar fate in their match against Tanzania. They will also not be among the nations to play the tournament after they were also eliminated in the first round of qualifiers following the second leg matches. In tennis news, Tunisia's Ons Jabeur will take on Argentina's Nadia Podoroska in the semifinals of the Ingebo Open on Friday. Jabeur had qualified for the semifinals of the competition after defeating Russia Vera Zvonareva in three sets of 7-5, 4-6, 6-1. And in cricket news, Cricket South Africa has announced the official commencement of the highly anticipated CSA Professional Domestic Women's League. The league is set to redefine the future of women's cricket in South Africa, bringing together the finest domestic talents in the country with the aim to elevate the game to new heights while providing equitable opportunities for women cricketers. The league consists of two formats, the CSA Women's One Day Cup and the CSA Women's T20 Challenge. And that's it for this Friday's edition of Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a nice weekend. And that's it for this Friday, September 29th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending your week with us. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms, including Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV shows, Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I am James Botti, Washington, wishing that you will have a great weekend.